Cheryl, if you can speak up so that the good people at the back can hear you. You can't.
Could you talk about that particular concept relative to your personal experience when the fall earthquake happened? And how, I mean, that was such, it's a recent and such a significant place where people felt a lot of angst and suffering for these people, and how,
Cheryl's asking about in relationship to the earthquakes in Nepal recently, and how to apply those principles in relationship to that. But it's really I would say is just in your meditation, just being ready to invite that in, maybe from seeing the pictures in the news or from wherever you see them, to bring that to mind, as to say, yeah, the earth is unstable, and this is what happened. Also, Kathmandu, there's an incredible number of brick buildings, and not very many building codes. I was there a couple of years ago, and the health and safety has not quite made it to Kathmandu, so there's a lot of very, very precarious building. And so that, seeing the pictures and just letting that into the heart, it's to not feel like you shouldn't be feeling sad, or that there shouldn't be waves of regret or unhappiness. But in a way, allowing that quality of caring and concern to arise in relationship to that, and also to celebrate the fact that you do care. It's in a way we can miss that. That is, it's a wonderful thing that we do care, and that even though there's a fragility or a tenderness in that. It's how marvelous that we do care. How marvelous that there's a concern for the well-being of others, and that a well-wishing. So a lot of it depends on that sense of being ready to be open, and to not be afraid of attending to that. In the northern Buddhist tradition, the embodiment of compassion is Guanji and Bodhisattva, which means the Bodhisattva who listens to the sounds or the cries of the world. And so that in a way, that quality of listening, it's a really wonderful spiritual symbol, because it's saying the root of compassion is listening. And then Guanyin has 1,000 hands each with an eye in it. Then you have 1,000 hands and 1,000 eyes that can engage, but the root is listening. And so that readiness to listen and to receive, that's the flavor of the world. There's a lot of pain. And also, when we consider our condition as living beings, it's never not been this way. I mean, not to trivialize things, but the earthquakes do happen, and beings get hurt in particular disasters, but the ongoing destruction of life, beings eating other beings, is happening all around us every day. And so that opening the heart to the brutality of the living world is part of it. And to say that how many creatures here in this area, they eat each other all the time. That walking through the garden, there's the blackbird listening for the worms. The worm is not saying, "Oh, I wonder which blackbird is going to eat me." It's not thinking that, but that's part of our the development of spiritual life is, say, being able to listen to that, to receive that. Yeah, the living world isn't all sweet and pleasant and friendly. That it's brutal, and there's a lot of creatures, vast numbers of creatures predate upon each other, and there's pain and fear that's involved in that. And if there's a real openness to that, and it was also interesting in this conference how they, because the title was Mindfulness and Compassion, that they one of the themes that came up over and over was that you can't really practice compassion without wisdom being involved. That the two are like the two wings of the bird, and you can't fully develop compassion without having the wisdom element. And that I would say that view of yes, it's you know, brutal and a violent world we're a part of, but yes, this is the way things are, and that the cool eye of wisdom and the caring heart of compassion, they belong together. They need each other. Yes. Again, if you could speak up so people can hear your question, that'd be helpful.
During the meditation, and I don't know if this is directly related to the topic of theirs, but during the meditation, you were talking about the mind being scattered and going off to different thoughts. And I've been struggling with this for quite a while, and the thing that I struggled the most with is figuring out what to do about out of the meditation, and maybe that's just the answer. But to give you an example, when I took precepts, I felt the precepts really helped me. They really changed. I felt the physical change, the five precepts, they made a huge difference. And I could see them as a marker. I could see the impact that I had on my anger, on my patience. I haven't been able to figure out anything that I could do that had that sort of practical thing as taking precepts and respecting to help my mind wander less. So if you had any recommendation out of it, just keep at it. I've got that before. It would be wonderful.
Well, one of the things is the peace doesn't come from the world stopping. Peace comes from the attitude that is held towards the world. And sometimes the world that's not stopping is the world of our thoughts. And if you notice, your mind can be bouncing around all over the place, and there can be that moment where there's a recognition of, it's totally berserk today. And that which knows that the mind is totally berserk is not berserk. Right? At that moment, it's like, this is crazy. That which knows this is crazy is not crazy. And so, again, this is one of those things where it's a common misconception, I would suggest, in terms of Buddhist practice, that peace means it's not thinking. And again, Ajahn Chah had a variety of different ways of pointing to that being a wrong view. So if not thinking was the point of meditation, then these chickens would be arahants, you know, because the forest chickens, they can sit there for days without moving. You know, they're really accomplished meditators, and they don't seem to be thinking very much either. You know, or this rock, you know, doesn't have any thoughts, but it's not liberated. It's just a rock. You know, it doesn't have consciousness in the same way that we do, and so. We can have the assumption that peace means not thinking. But you can have a mind with no thoughts in it, which is far from liberated. You know, I've had that experience myself where you're sitting there and thinking, quiet. So... this doesn't feel like nirvana. This feels like an empty room, you know. And so that the genuine quality of peace is not in whether there's thoughts or no thoughts, but in the attitude towards it. And obviously, the less thoughts there are, the easier it is generally to sustain a skillful and clear attitude. But that I feel is a very, very useful principle to bring to mind. Because otherwise it's like, you think, I can't be peaceful unless, you know, I'm in the right place. If I've got these noisy neighbors, or I've got to go into the city, then the city is a problem. The highway is a problem. Your neighbors are a problem. You know, your partner's a problem. The kids are a problem. Your parents are a problem. You know, the whole world is a problem because it's interrupting, you know, my practice. So I'd say that's a clear indication that you've got the wrong that's the wrong idea of what the practice is. But I'm not making that assumption, but you know, if one is thinking that way. But rather, yeah, sure, I mean, the monasteries are quiet places. We keep the precepts so that the people's behavior is very respectful and predictable and gentle. And so, yeah, we like silence and such like. But if the practice is well-grounded, then you're using those environments of silence and restraint and stillness so that then you can go on the highway, you can go into the city, and it's not a problem. You can sit.
What do you do in this environment of silence? I guess that's what I'm aiming for. What is the practice? What would you
essentially
focus the mind and not react?
Non-contention. Like I came on a plane from England, a 10-hour flight, and there was I was in economy, and there was two quite large people on either side. Yeah, not to be sizist, but they relatively speaking, they were not small people. So I had to just sort of basically expand my personal shrink myself and expand my sense of space internally. Because I couldn't move very much. And so I could sit there making a problem out of it, or I could sit there and not make a problem out of it. So non-contention with the way things are is you know, the key to happiness, really. And that seeing where the mind is trying to find fault, like it shouldn't be this way, or that's not fair, or what about me? And to recognize, well, at this moment it's like this. And that in each moment, it's like with the heat in the room. You know, it's up to me. It's up to me whether I make a problem out of it or not. And that that quality of non-contention—it's a choice, moment by moment. And it's again, it's not a matter of praising passivity. It's not a matter of trying to be just numb. But non-contention doesn't mean you don't act, but it means that you're not turning anything into the enemy. Or not turning anything into a problem. Yeah, there's a hand over there. Yeah.
As conscious beings, don't we have some responsibility during this drought to speak with the fish?
Insofar as one can, yeah.
Yeah. But to have our to have that as a responsibility of consciousness, because we, you know, we are those conscious beings. We're not rocks.
Mm-hmm.
So to really make actually some effort somehow to take into consideration being in harmony with nature.
Yeah, for each individual, there's going to be particular things that strike us. We feel a certain empathy with certain creatures. So maybe you feel an empathy with a fish and think. And that's fine. But also to recognize, well, I feel inclined to do what I can, and then you give yourself to doing what you can, but then not creating suffering about what you can't do. That's also part, I would say, is where wisdom and compassion meet, is to recognize that if you could do more, you would do more, but what you can't do is out of your control. And that... And that's something, it took me years and years to get a feeling for that, because I used to suffer about everything. Yeah. I wasn't allowed to watch Bambi when I was a kid. I was so tender, the family wouldn't, it's true, they wouldn't let me watch Bambi because they knew that I would just be in tears for a week and that they wouldn't be able to live with it. So it was like, they'd tell me, oh, it's not very good, no, you don't want to see it. Because I would have been inconsolable. For weeks or months, so I suffered a lot from that. But I one of the most beautiful and skillful teachings that you get from Buddha Dhamma is you recognize that you do what you can to help, but what you can't do, then you leave alone. And also, there's no sense of lack on account of that. And that's a wonderful and powerful teaching, that when the Buddha saw that there were limits of what he could do to help others, he knew he did what he could, but what he couldn't do, he just had to leave alone. And that's hard for us to do, because our thinking minds keep spinning like, well, I should, and maybe, and what if, and we love that what if, and I should. But if we really apply wisdom, then we recognize, well, that the car's already over the cliff, I can't bring it back. You know, all I can do is put my hands together and send forth well wishing. I can't undo something that's irreversible. It's not doable. So if I make suffering within myself over it, then you got sort of two suffering beings instead of just one. And so, which is not trying to be too clinical about it, but in a sense, applying that wisdom faculty to it, saying that to have faith that if I could do more, I would do more. I know that. But I haven't got the capacity to do more, so what I can do in this moment is this, and what I can't do, I won't create suffering about. And it took me a long time to really digest that, but the more that I have done, then it's like I'm an abbot of a monastery with about 50 residents. I can't make everybody happy. It's like, you know, if you sort of were Mary Poppins, you know, you could snap your fingers and make everyone cheerful, but it doesn't work that, you know, you can't make everyone happy. But you are responsible for helping others to make themselves happy. And if they do it, then great. If they don't do it, then so be it. Yes.
So in meditation, there's experience of observing these things of thoughts and sensations and feelings, and then at times it's like I'm observing the observer inside of me. So is observation a thought process? Is it a being process? Is it and then it kind of disappears sometimes, but as soon as the thoughts come up, I'm observing those. So there's this, and then I notice that I'm observing my thoughts, and I'm observing. It's fascinating.
Well,
the question, I guess, is, so what exactly is that experience, and what's going on with that?
Well, I'd say that the genuine observing or awareness is not a thought process. The awareness is that there's a knowing of thought, but the quality of awareness itself is not thinking. So that thought, and when the mind is really very, very clear, then there can be a clear awareness of thoughts arising and ceasing, and that so that that which knows the thought is not a thought. And one of the issues of meditation is of the sense of endlessly recessive numbers of Noahs. You know, great fleas have little fleas upon their backs to bite them, and little fleas have lesser fleas, and so ad infinitum. You know? But they're kind of endlessly sort of the watcher watching the watcher watching the watcher watching the. But if there's a clear awareness, then that any feeling of I. There's a quality of awareness, and then that feeling of I am watching, or I'm aware, or this is me who's knowing, that's actually a departure. That's another thought that sort of arises. So it's like if awareness is the back wall, then the thought I'm aware, the mind has already grabbed hold of something that has arisen. It's left that back wall of pure awareness, and it's taken hold of that feeling of I'm simply being the watcher here. There's no ego. It's just, you know, there is just the watcher. But it's all by that very naming and identifying, it's already left that quality of pure awareness. So the more that quality of awareness, that sort of unbiased knowing is established, then that the more that there is a profound security. So when we talk about taking refuge in the Buddha, it's essentially being that awareness. Buddha means that which knows, or that the one who is awake, or the one who is aware. And so taking refuge in Buddha doesn't just mean trusting that Gautama Buddha, the teacher of 2,500 years ago, but it means essentially being awake, being that aware quality that is able to know and to attune to the rising and passing away of all experience, but without confusion or identification. That which knows doubt is not doubting. Yes. Yeah.
I'm really grateful to be here. I'm really, I didn't realize that you were going to be talking because I didn't remember that your name was Ajahn Damara, but it was Jimin. I don't know who Ajahn Jimin is, but that's what I thought your name was. So I didn't know you went to England either, so this is very nice to be here. I have, my most difficult relationship is with my brother, and I haven't talked to him in 4 years until the first of this month. And he told me I have own property jointly with him, and he's lost all of it, and I've never gotten anything. And I feel, when I was talking to him, I feel all so many bigger things, and right now I feel really tight about it. And I did have a moment of letting go, feeling, I don't know how it happened, it was accidental, just completely no grasping onto anything, and I just felt all this love and peace, and then all of a sudden it went, you know, in a few days it was like back again to the tightness. And I appreciate, you know, what you've been talking about, but mostly I appreciate your kind presence that I've always felt that you've had, and I've really been grateful. Yeah. Because you're just pretty much the opposite of how my brother is. And I always felt that affection for you, and I'm really grateful. Manifest something that I would like to have within myself that I feel that you've always had that, and I've kind of just kind of like taken it for granted, and I didn't even know you were gone for 5 years. So thank you. And I don't have anything to say about, I'm feeling really, after that insight of openness, I felt way more clear about how abusive my brother is to me, and how much am I supposed to put up with this? Am I supposed to put up with it or not? I'm not sure. So this is the history of my life, is this person and my family system is the same. I thought I'm right back to the old family system that is so controlling. It's kind of like in between two big people and an airplane that's never going to land.
Yeah. Well, I have a the phrase suppose
aversion and grasping and aversion my companions. So.
Yeah, well, the words supposed to are a bit loaded, I would say, because there isn't really a supposed to. There's no because it's the choice is really up to us how we relate to each situation. I think what you describe, I feel, is it's very, very helpful, because that spontaneous experience of acceptance or love for your brother and peace with it, it gives you a context. Like all the other stuff of the narrative, of like, he shouldn't have done this and that's not fair. But yeah, that all might be true, but also there's this kind of bigger picture of, well, here we are, and that this particular issue is not the whole story. Okay, in terms of how to handle a situation, often the most helpful thing is to put aside as much of the shoulds and shouldn'ts as you can, and just to make the mind as clear as possible, and just ask yourself the question. Yeah, you know the whole story already, so just ask yourself the question: is there anything to be done with the situation? You know what the situation is. You've got the whole story in your memory. You don't need to spell it out. But just to let your mind be as quiet as possible and just invite that in. Just say, is there anything to be done? And just see what arises. That's the act of listening. You're listening to your own, you're consulting your own heart. You're listening to your own heart. And it can be very surprising sometimes because it can be very unpredictable. When you ask, and it's totally dependent on the chemistry of a situation, it can be like, well, now you ask, actually, there's a few things. Oh, right. it can be something that that encourages a great deal of engagement or activity or taking initiative. Or at the other end of the scale, it can be, there's nothing to be done. There's nothing to do. Leave it alone. Just walk away. And you can't tell for each individual person, each situation, what will be kind of quote-unquote the right thing. Because it's never really fixed. It depends on so many different factors from moment to moment and person to person. So that's what I trust is that kind of reflective investigation. To, in a sense, consult your own wisdom, your own attunement to the situation, so you're getting away from all the lists of shoulds and shouldn'ts, and just drawing upon your own feel, your own feeling for what's happening. Speaking about the feeling for what's happening, it's now 5:45, 6:10 to 6 already, so time has gone by. So perhaps we can draw things to a close. Do you share blessings or anything like that?
It's up to you.
Okay. So we can close with our traditional chant of the sharing of blessings. So this is a way we have a reflection that we use to say recollect that we. The good actions that we do don't just affect or enrich us, but they also touch the lives of others as well. We affect each other. This is a relational system. And so those of you who know the words to this chant do feel welcome to join in, or those of you who don't, just listen to what we say and use this as a way of offering up whatever goodness has come from this gathering together this afternoon. Whatever has been of benefit, then to offer that to share and to be a blessing and a resource for all other beings, especially thirsty, the parched beings. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration through the goodness that arises from my practice. May my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces
celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice. And through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my Bulno. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.